There we go, we're underway. Nobody swear. No, I'm joking. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Hello, everyone. Welcome to, again, another really excited day for us because someone that we love talking to and usually brings us wonderful gifts to try and drink every time we see him. Tom, I'm hoping you've brought some, like, is the postman turning up now or for this?
Yeah, I'm afraid not. I can put together a package for you guys, though. I can do that. I've got some new bits, actually, that are quite wild and wacky that you'd like to try. So, yeah.
That was a good trip, Andy.
That was easier.
Live on air in the recording. Solid.
Nowhere to hide.
The camera kicks in, right?
we are speaking to the wonderful Tom Bartram today. We're just going to talk about everything under the sun, if we can, because he's probably one of the most knowledgeable people that we know, not just with rum, but with like agave spirits and stuff like that. So, we're just going to kind of see what happens, one of those today. We have a couple of questions, obviously, but, you know, it's kind of... See where the afternoon takes us, I suppose. First things first, Tom, can we just kind of get a bit of a sort of background of you and where you're from and what you've done and what you do now and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. I currently work for Specialty Brands, although on furlough at the moment, which you can pretty much tell from my bottom half down, which is still pajamas. I've originally from Leicestershire, but escaped there as pretty much as soon as possible. No offense, Leicester, if anyone's out there from there. And cut my bartending teeth in Leeds. Really got taken by the whole world of booze, the history behind it, the world of the cocktails as well. And yeah, eventually started working for Brands, which was about 13 years ago. God, I'm old. I've been happily doing that ever since. So yeah, currently I work for Specialty Brands, which work a lot in the rum category in particular, but also a lot with whiskies and agave spirits, all sorts of spirit categories. Key sort of rum brands that we work with, this is Diplomatico from Venezuela. We also work with Trois-Rivières, which from Martinique. Then also Velier, which is quite a big one for us. So Velier, a company that do amazing rum bottlings and some really weird and wonderful stuff, which is obviously the stuff that we've tasted quite recently. That's about it professionally wise.
Cool. So yeah, obviously you're kind of like a bit of an OG now, really, of the industry, right? Like you've been doing something hospitality related for quite some time. Things change so much. Like, what would you say, like, some of the biggest changes you've noticed from, like, when you were behind the bar, now being on the other side? Like, what's kind of some of the biggest leaps forward, would you say, that you've seen?
I think availability of different styles of pretty much every spirit and better examples of every spirit, as well as some not so great examples of lots of spirits to join the market. Like, I can remember when the first bar that I proper bar worked in was Trio and Skipper's Bar in Headingley in Leeds, which was sort of one of those bars where most people from the Leeds bar scene came through originally. So Declan McGurk of the Savoy was my bar manager at that time. Loads of the other people who I worked with, people like Tom Vernon, who's now Woodford Global, all came through this bar. And we had particularly had quite a big rum selection, but 30 bottles? We were known for having this amazing, massive rum selection. But, if you looked at it from today's perspective, it would have been some quite basic brands that were just, you know, all known in most bars. So we're having this great movement nowadays that people are more interested in what they drink. And more of the sort of specialities, more highly flavorful spirits. Spirits with more provenance are coming to market. That's probably one of the most exciting things in regards to like what I do now working for brands. Obviously, cocktails is a whole nother world, and to get into all the developments, what's happened in that time, on the menu when I first started in 2003. You know, there's probably a woo-woo on there and whatnot, which obviously, nice. If you're in one of the bars that won, you know, award-winning bars nowadays, you probably wouldn't have a woo-woo on the menu. So obviously we came on leaps and bounds in cocktails as well. But there again, you know, some of the good classic drinks that you could get by bartenders back then hasn't necessarily improved that much. You know, you could get a banging classic back then probably as equally as you could get one from a bar now. There was a lot less bars doing cocktails then, so the general standard was, you know, pretty good, even though we had a woo-woo on the menu, sort of thing. So I don't know.
I'm going in hard on the woo-woo.
I could have picked out Jube as well. There's a few of them.
So would you say that rum was kind of like your first love then spirit-wise, or was there something else that really got your attention initially?
Yeah, my old man always was a big Scotch drinker, and that's probably the first like good spirits that I got exposed to. Trio was very much had a rum selection. Skippy, who's a proper OG, a legend of the North, but Northern bar scene, who used to work for Specialty Brands as well, but he was one of the bar managers back then. His love was rum, so that was mainly his thing that he built up on Trio. And I obviously picked up quite a lot of that. But then when we opened Skipper's Bar upstairs in 2004, tequila became a big focus. And, you know, most bars back then probably didn't know what 100% agave tequila was. And we had 20, 25 different 100% agave tequilas, most of which no one had ever, you know, seen or heard of in this country.
Even a mezcal. Quite a wide selection. Oh, yeah. Mezcal as well, so far
there's
back.
One yeah. brand of bad mezcal, to be fair. It wasn't really until 2008, 2009 that we started getting good mezcal here, so, yeah.
Nice. Because it seems really weird. I mean, I'm quite new still to the hospitality world, really. Like, I always, if someone asks me about it, I always kind of describe myself as a bit of a late bloomer. Like, I didn't really come into it until I was about 22. So that was like 5 years ago now. So there's quite a lot of trends that I've kind of not seen come and go. I'm kind of almost like looking back on it as like a bit of a historical thing. I'm kind of backtracking, seeing what motions people have gone through already, and then trying to recognize some of the things that are currently like flaring up and might potentially, you know, start to pick up. And I guess one phrase you always hear is like, oh, such and such is going to be the next big thing, you know, like
yeah.
Tequila was one of those things that I've heard in recent times. You know, tequila is going to be the next big thing. People always say, even though rum's kind of always been there as a bit of an undercurrent, people are saying, oh, there's going to be like a rum explosion, kind of like there was a gin one, you know, or vodka back in the day. Do you kind of have any explanation, given that you work in the job that you have now, is there any kind of reason for that, do you think? Is it like kind of pushed by people in your sort of position, or is it just bartenders kind of finding something they like and it kind of builds up some momentum, or what do you think it is?
It's a bit of both. There's usually always some brand involvement and, you know, money in advertising campaigns at consumers does play a big part in it. It depends whether we look at these trends as, you know, becoming a big thing within our sort of geeky spirit circles, or whether it becoming a proper big consumer trend. Like a real big consumer trend does take a lot of pushing from all sides, I think. Gin just went nuts. It's now, you know, in the latter stages of that. But I don't think for a while there's going to be another spirit that rivals what gin achieved in those years. So just from a bit of a historical perspective, back when I first started doing stock takes in bars, mid-noughties, so about 2004, 2005, vodka would outsell all of the speed rail spirits by a long way, at least three times as much as the closest rival. Rum would probably be the next one behind before gin. Gin would win like maybe third or fourth largest selling spirit. Obviously, if you look at a bar nowadays, like they sell more twice as much gin sometimes than even vodka. Gin's rise was absolutely phenomenal. Has it gone too far? I think we can pretty much agree that it has. Are people ready for something different? The signs are showing that they are. What will fill the gap is still to be determined. But yeah, a lot of people have been talking about rum filling that gap. The trouble is, one of the main parts of the rum world that is going to fill a lot of the mainstream is Spystrom, that we've already seen quite a big spike in Spystrom. And by EU legislation, Spystrom isn't really rum. You're not allowed to flavour rum with anything. It's a spirit drink. So one of the main categories of rum that we're going to see pushing the rum category into the consumer sphere isn't really rum. So, you know, how does that affect it?
Do you think it's going to get as weird as, like, gin has got with, like, random, really bizarre flavours and stuff like that? Or...
Well, we're already starting to see quite a lot of flavoured rums hit the market. Whether as many brands will come out as the gin world, and whether there'll be as many producers of rum locally as there are of gin, because obviously gin is very easy to make, but it's very easy to get a rum brand made for you as well. I suspect not as quite as crazy as gin. There's not going to be so many brands, I don't think. Thank God. But we're just going to have to see where it goes. It's hard to tell at this stage. We've seen a noticeable increase in demand as well for premium rum, which is really good signs as well. Things like the Velier bottlings now, you know, mainly from the more kind of educated ones in the know part of the rum world, has been pretty phenomenal, the way that the interest in those and the sales of those has gone up. So, but Diplomatica as well, and those style of consumer sipping rooms seem to be doing very well as well. So, yeah. But, still pretty small in comparison to gin.
We'll topple it one day.
Yeah.
we've always said, as long as we don't see anything that's kind of like a pink rum or something that's like luminous, or sort of like a, what would you say, kind of like a, you know, palmer violet flavored gin, or you know, some kind of retro sweet flavored gin, probably okay for the most part.
yeah
absolutely.
Do you think that some of that might be due to, or like, what's the way to phrase it, do you think that this kind of maybe keeping it under control when it comes to flavors and styles and whatnot, do you think some of that will be due to pushback from some of the figureheads in the industry? Like myself and Andy recently, and before we came on here, we were talking a little bit about the idea of GIs and the prospects that some might be getting tweaked, some might be getting introduced. There's a little bit of back and forth. It's kind of like a hot topic at the moment in the rum world. In your view, do you think that the introduction of these things, or kind of like, you know, implementing them in more places, is more likely to sort of like retain and quality control a little bit when it comes to these products that are coming out? Or do you think there's a chance that it might actually stunt some of the growth and creativity in the category, or a bit of both?
I guess it depends who you speak to in this one. I think GIs are a very good tool. GIs are geographical indications, is what they are. They're basically legal framework that a country will put together with producers of said product to basically protect. The main job is to protect that country's products from being counterfeited by another country or by producers from outside of that country. We know of various different words for this as well. Like, you get AOCs, Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, which is the French term, which they are a GI, but a very specific style of GI, that along with denominations of origin, which you get in Spanish-speaking countries. AOCs and DOs generally stipulate that the base ingredient has to come from a certain area within that country, whereas GIs don't normally stipulate that. So if we look at Scotch whiskey or Jamaican rum, for example, the molasses for sugarcane cane syrup for the Jamaican rum doesn't have to come from Jamaica. It can come from another country. As the grain for Scotch whiskey, which is just a, you know, regular GI, can come from outside of Scotland, outside of the UK. So that's the main difference, that they're all GIs, but AOs and AOCs and DOs are specific types of quite special GIs, normally with more more rigorous controls. Whether these are a good thing or not, I think it depends how they're used. They can definitely protect products and protect the quality of products, but they can also, because these things are usually put together by, with a consensus of the government of that country and producers, they can be manipulated in certain ways to benefit certain influential producers. Usually those producers will kind of represent their own agenda in it. We can see this with Mexican spirits quite heavily, with tequila and with mezcal. There's a lot of issues there about arguing what should be in place and what should happen, or whether they should even exist. But in the rum world, we have quite a few. AOC Rum Martinique is a very famous one. They've had that in place since 1996. How can, whether that's helped benefit its exports, I'm not too sure. Other than France, there's not a massive amount of sales outside of France of AOC Rum Martinique, unfortunately, because it's delicious. Then you have DO Ronda Venezuela, which is another denomination of origin, which protects that spirit there. And various other ones. We've obviously seen Jamaica come out a few years ago. And the big discussion at the moment is the Barbados rum GI, which is quite interesting. And, both Jamaica and Barbados are trying to, protect the premium reputation of their rooms, we're all hearing about the issues that are affecting the Barbados one. So basically the issue seems to be that it was almost agreed originally what it would be. The rules were very, very similar to the Jamaican GI that passed. Nothing too crazy. Just that it's got to be from that country. Again, it's just a GI, so it doesn't stipulate that the base ingredient has to come from that country. So Jamaica can import molasses, Barbados would be able to as well. But there are certain stipulations, like it had to be matured on the island. I guess once you start maturing something overseas, there's the element of losing control over, what happens to that spirit. And also no sugar additions for Jamaica and what was being proposed for Barbados. But one of the distilleries in Barbados was purchased. And after that point, that distillery and the new owners decided to question some of the things specifically because it didn't really benefit their brand and what they do. And, they're just representing their point of view and their business interests. And you could argue that's the same thing for the three producers on Barbados who are advocating for the original geographic indication. So it's all a big argument. Barbados needs consensus across all of those producers to actually put something in place. And I don't see a point that it will get to a consensus between those producers at the moment. So I guess this will probably just go on for a long time. Whether consumers really, really care that much, I guess it depends on your level of consumer. Most of them won't know what a geographical indication is, because why would you? If you're not really into it. Especially for reassuring quality to the people who really love that spirit and are very much into it, they can be very useful. We will see how it comes out. What was the other part of the question, by the way? Sorry, I've just been rambling.
No. So it's all really interesting. To be honest, I can't quite remember what I asked.
I think it's about how the role of GIs and if they're important, I guess.
It was that, and obviously kind of given that those would be in place, I guess, do you think that it would certainly help avoid a situation like the gin kind of craze, where there was a lot of things by the end of it not even really resembling what gin is, that were selling quite well. Would you say on the whole, I'd be under the impression that these GIs would basically it'd kind of avoid that situation happening. You know, it's quality controlling, and it would mean that the market's not getting too saturated, and there's not these products that are getting messed around with and tweaked to the point where they're almost unrecognizable. But do you think that's kind of smart for the survival of the category, or do you think it kind of needs to branch out and get more experimental and quirky and advertiser friendly and that kind of thing?
Well, I think keeping a balance of the two is very important. You know, it is important to make sure that, you know, something labelled as a Barbados rum or a Jamaican rum isn't pink with loads of flavourings in, or any other colour for that matter. I'm not taking it out in pink at all. And, you know, there's nothing to stop those producers from making something on that island that could be flavoured or could be, you know, whatever, outside of those rules of what will be put in place, but it just wouldn't be allowed to be called, you know, Barbados or Jamaican rum. So it's protecting those terms. So yeah, I think it's really important that they protect it to their traditions. Leaving some sort of space for creativity can be important, but we've got to make sure that doesn't detract from what, you know, that product is and what really makes that denomination. So
yeah, definitely. No, I totally agree. I think as long as the transparency is there for the consumer, I don't think it necessarily shuts all the doors on the creativity and such. You know, it's just going to be a little bit, might cause some instances of sort of rebranding or readjusting, you know, marketing strategies and that kind of thing. But I think as long as people have the freedom to, you know, work with the liquids and have a play around, I don't really see why it would kind of stump creativity and evolution of the category, you know.
The main two areas currently in the Barbados discussion of creativity is mainly due to post-distillation operations of basically aging. So aging outside of Barbados to be permitted, and also to the use of non-oak woods to be permitted, which is being proposed by Maison Ferrand. Also the addition of sugar they want to include in that as well, which is essentially part of their brand. If you look at most different denominations around the world, most different geographical indications, or what the norm is for most spirits around the world, oak is typically used. Oak has been the driving force of aging spirits and the main thing to age spirits in for our history. It's very well suited to it. But some categories, you know, have used chestnut and other woods in the past. Their argument is whether that has historically been used in Barbados, which, to be honest, I'm not clued upon all that history to be able to tell that. But there is intense debate going on. And then the other part of it is the addition of sugar. EU rules are coming into place to limit that at 20 grams of sugar per litre, which have been published for a while now, but there was a period of letting people get away with it. Also, EU rules on these sort of things they're not always imposed as strictly as they should be. Barbados has got to determine whether they will allow that or not. So many countries do allow the addition of sugar. Some countries limit it, and some countries just completely have a ban on it. Obviously, Jamaica and Martinique are two examples of that. The addition of sugar, I don't think, is a really creativity. That's just a way to, round off a product. So I think it's more when we talk about limiting creativity within specifically the Barbados GI, it's this whether oak or any type of wood should be permitted to be used.
Do you think this EU law is going to have a big impact on these kind of Spanish style sort of sipping rums that obviously typically kind of have some sugar added to them?
Yeah, there are a lot of sipping rums on the market that do have well over 20 grams of sugar per litre added to it. Some of those brands have already started to gradually reduce that. But some of them will either have to make the call whether to, you know, change their profile quite significantly by bringing that down to 20 grams per liter, or whether to not label themselves as a room. So that will be the choice eventually when it's enforced. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Whether the consumer will notice, you know, there's a lot of people who do enjoy these rums that are quite heavily sweetened, probably don't even realize they're quite heavily sweetened. And, you know, when they come down to 20 grams of sugar per litre, they'll probably notice and go, oh, don't really like this as much anymore. So we're going to have to see whether that does actually happen. It's quite a difficult argument because, you know, if we're taking away the enjoyment for those people who enjoy something slightly sweeter. Is that a good thing?
It's a bit of a catch-22, isn't it? Because we find it's kind of like people where, you know, we'll be trying to sort of like guide people in the right direction, open the door to rum for a lot of people. We tend to find that some of those sweeter styles are such a gateway in, such a good gateway in, you know? And I think if you were trying to sort of like, if you tried to do it in a way where they were defined as something different, it doesn't necessarily create such a clear pathway into the category. Because there's plenty of people that, myself included, that 2-3 years ago, I would have been drinking these sweeter styles. And yeah, I don't know, maybe like subconsciously kind of like, it feels quite nice, doesn't it? To be like, okay, well, I'm actually sipping and enjoying some of the nuances in like a neat spirit. If all of a sudden someone just stops by and says, oh, it's actually more of a liqueur and it's something a bit different, you know, it's hard to explain, but it kind of feels, it sort of takes away a little bit of that, a little bit of like the class and the style, doesn't it? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And it'd be tough. I certainly think it'd be tough to get as many people interested initially if that element is kind of stripped away. Kind of like if you're thinking about something like a whiskey, like a scotch, if you try and just get people to try like something that's really heavily peated right off the bat, there's a good fair chance they're just not going to come back to it again, are they? But then if you were trying to say that, you know, a different style of scotch, it's not real scotch, you know? It's like, no, this is just like the average Joe's kind of scotch. If you don't know what you're talking about, you'll drink this. It puts a lot of people off. Me personally, I'm not like a very big fan of like snobbery, if that's even a word. I think people like what they like, and I wouldn't really want to close the door on anyone. But then, yeah, on the flip side, I totally understand the rationale behind wanting to really protect and preserve these traditional practices and quality, obviously, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I can appreciate the position of pretty much all of the people who have all of the producers who have a strong opinion on this. Like, if you look at the position of those who do not use added sugar, especially, you know, there's one particular very, very cool rum producer from Barbados on it, God bless him. He's been making rum how he feels rum should be made in the country where the word rum comes from, and does that without seeing, doing what he sees as cheating, which is adding sugar. And there's no way he's going to change his mind about that. And, you know, why should he? But there again, if you look at this from a Latin American perspective where, you know, generations have been doing this practice, they're now being told by the EU that they have to reduce that amount to a maximum of 20 grams of sugar per litre. But Brandy de Jerez, for example, can use up to 35 grams of sugar per litre into their brandy, which is more than rum from outside of the EU is permitted to use. You know, both those producers of Brandy de Jerez, Spanish brandy, and producers wherever they are in Guatemala or Venezuela or whatnot, have grown up with a similar style of production of adding sugar to their spirits. But these guys within the EU for making Spanish brandy are allowed to use much more, and the guys who are not really represented outside of the EU are not allowed to use that amount of sugar in rum. So that seems a little bit, you can see their perspective and why they would be annoyed about that as well. So,
do you think it might even have a worse impact, say, people that are these producers that maybe are trying to reduce the amount of sugar might start adding other things to keep the sort of flavour profile similar? Do you think that's going to become an issue as well?
Well, flavoured rums won't be allowed to be called rums still. There are different elements that you can add to spirits to help smoothen it off. Glycerin is used a lot in quite a few industries where it's not banned, which gives you a richer sense of texture on the palate, but you can normally taste it. The main offending spirit that I find with that particular additive is tequila, where it's permitted. Taste a big lineup of tequilas and you can start to really feel it on your palate after a while. I can't remember where the EU, I think as far as I'm aware, the EU won't permit that to be used in rum. So I don't think there are any other additives other than caramel colouring, obviously, that will be permitted other than sugar. So I think we're okay there. Unless they just jump over to making a spirit drink, which is what flavoured rums, as we know them, will be referred to as.
Yeah, I imagine there's going to be a lot of rebranding coming.
Yeah. Captain Morgan's and some of the other ones obviously already do this. And, you know, rum-flavoured spirit drink. But, you know, you're not going to make spirit drink look as prominent as you would normally make the word rum look prominent. So.
Yeah, it's weird because I guess the average person on the street, if you were to ask them, they would still just classify it as rum, right? Even though they've forcibly had to change the marketing and whatnot. I think some of these more subtle differences, people might not even notice too much of a change anyway. You know, I guess it's until they do it, they're not going to know. But then I guess a company on a scale as large as that might not be willing to take the risk that they're going to suddenly see a massive plummet in sales. In terms of rum, is there anything you're drinking at the moment or anything you're kind of wanting to get to try once all this current situation sort of over with? Anything exciting rum wise
I've been a little bit fortunate to have a few really tasty bottlings in my house that I've been probably enjoying very much recently. Couple of them,
here we go.
Oh no, did I almost show my pajamas?
I'm so jealous.
This one, there we go, is from the National Rums of Jamaica Limited, which is basically Valier bottlings of some historic marks of rum. And this one is Wedderburn style, so that's between 150 and 250 grams per hectolitre of esters. And this one is Vale Royal, which was a historical distillery that closed, I think it's back in the 1950s. But that mark got carried on by the Long Pond Distillery. And this was quite often the case when a distillery closed, that another distillery would take over making that mark. So this is part of a range of quite a few. And the others are mainly continental flavoured, which is the highest level that we see, highest parts per million investors. So this is a lot more drinkable than the other ones. The other ones are delicious, but you kind of have a sip and you're like, so I've been enjoying this quite a bit. The other thing that I've been quite excited about is actually from Reunion Island.
Is that the Habitation Valley bottle one?
Yeah, this is the one from the Savannah Distillery, which make, again, a very high ester level of rum. I just couldn't believe this was rum the first time I tried it. I've not really been exposed to the Savannah Distillery much before trying this bottle in. You don't really get much from there. But they have this very peculiar pot still setup, which you'll see in the diagram there. It's just incredible. It tastes almost like those little banana sweets that you get in pick a mixes. Couldn't believe that a sugarcane or molasses-based spirit could taste like this. I've been quite excited about that. Obviously, I'm quite a fan of agave spirits and mezcal and the weird and wonderful. And this definitely fits into that world. So
nice. What in terms of any kind of rum based cocktails that are favourites? Because obviously, whenever we've been talking before, it's always more just like spirit specific. But obviously, from the bartending background, was there any cocktails back then, or is there any cocktails now that you really like, particularly rum based stuff?
Yeah, I think the more I've sort of tasted more and more spirits and everything, the further I've got away from cocktails, like for actual personal consumption. And as soon as that's been a good 8 years since I was properly behind a bar now, I'm not that kind of, I don't experiment as much as I used to. With rum, pretty much daiquiris, rum old fashions is where I'm at.
Can't go wrong.
Yeah. but I quite like playing around with different base spirits to see how they affect those things. You know, a daiquiri, you know, if we just order a daiquiri in a bar and get house rum, you know, it can be a delicious drink or whatnot. But, you know, there's such a myriad of flavors that you can get from just changing that base spirit, keeping the spec exactly the same, but changing the base spirit. I love Agricole daiquiris. I love Clarin daiquiris as well.
Yeah.
I like... the kind of more flavor forward elements in my daiquiris. That's the sort of drink that I'll make for myself at home if I do make a cocktail as well. Something 3 ingredients max, easy.
Nice.
There is something about a Saju daiquiri though. Oh.
Yeah, Clarence Saju daiquiri is incredible.
So something you kind of alluded to before, you were saying obviously like your palate's kind of been shaped by the amount of things you've been exposed to and tried. And a big part of that these days is sort of like the agave spirit side of things. And obviously you're very big on pushing mezcal, you know, more to the forefront. When you kind of started on that journey, I presume you kind of came up to some different roadblocks than you would if you were, say, promoting like rum or gin, because they're already very well established. Unless, I mean, it only kind of came onto my radar a few years ago, mezcal as a category and things like that. Did you find when you were sort of like first getting that into the UK market, obviously you weren't just promoting kind of like brands, you're almost like, I presume, developing the category as you went. Did you find that kind of provided some new challenges for you as well?
Yeah, definitely. Agave spirits have always been a bit of a struggle in the UK market. Mainly because tequila's not really transcended as easily into the premium world as it has in the States over here. We've kind of been stuck in the general perception in the public of tequila being a sort of inferior party spirit that you just drink as quickly as possible. And that's still, you know, I still do talks on tequila where that's a lot of people's only experience of it. So mezcal over the last few years has probably been easier in a way that there's no preconceptions about it already. So if you manage to speak to people and equate it, you know, not too closely with tequila, those people with those negative thoughts on tequila and experiences of tequila, just look at mezcal from a new light, which can be easier to promote it than tequila itself. In the early days, it was a challenge. Like finding anything out about it was a challenge. So I went on holiday to New York in 2008 and went to all of the sort of like top hip bars of that time, the Milk and Honey's, the PDT's and Death & Co, which is still there now. It's a great bar. And the US was just starting to get into mezcal by that point, or the bartenders there were just starting to get into mezcal. But there was still no decent brands of mezcal in the UK. There was a few, Con Gusano, which is a little worm in the bottle, kind of industrial mezcals over here, but nothing like the traditional stuff that we get over here today. I can remember sitting at the bar in Death & Co. and this bartender, you know, introducing to me, it's like, I've only just recently started tasting this stuff, but it's incredible. It's like tequila, but so much more depth and complexity to it. And I tasted it. And I still remember sitting there at the bar, you know, exactly what was around me and tasting that spirit. And it just changed my world completely, changing my perspective on things. And when I got back, there's probably a handful of other people in the industry that had been over to Mexico and, you know, tried proper mezcal. So there wasn't really too many people to talk to about it. And I was just, mezcal, going crazy for it. And everyone was like, yeah, Tom, whatever, sort of thing. But then later, a few more brands, about end of 2008, 2009, more brands started coming over here. And it slowly started growing. But the last few years have been pretty incredible for it. Still not really broke out of that niche bubble, but it's starting to show signs of it. I was speaking to a family friend who lives in Leicestershire, well away from our sort of bubble of premium spirits and stuff. And he started asking me about mezcal, and I was like, wow, how did you even hear of mezcal? And seen it on Rick Stein, and was just, you know, saw the small scale production, was really interested in it. I think mainstream sort of exposure like that, programs like that is really helped bring it to a wider audience, but it's definitely an acquired taste. So whether that will grow significantly, we're not too sure.
Yeah, so you say it's quite an out there flavor. Even what would be deemed as the more kind of like tame variants are still quite full on, aren't they? And obviously the kind of price point as well, given its availability and production methodology, even your entry level kind of mezcals are gonna cost a little bit more. So it's a bit of a daunting prospect, I presume, whether it be for general consumers or also for bartenders as well. I mean, when we're doing menus and such, and you know, we try and get things like mezcal drinks on there, but then you're worrying about GPs a little bit. It can be quite tough to find a good enough mezcal for what would be kind of considered a reasonable price. I presume though that cocktails are another quite good way to sort of get the category out there a little bit. Though once it starts featuring in cocktails, you can start slipping it in there a little bit more. Once it starts appearing on menus and then bars are buying it up a little bit more, it'll kind of feed some money back in. And
yeah, definitely. It took me a little while to really kind of accept mezcal in cocktails, because eventually I got out to Oaxaca and spent a bit of time there between jobs, and really sort of infatuated with the world of it. But very much over there, you know, mezcal is drunk neat. It's very, you know, there's no deviation from that really. And it took me a while to actually find a cocktail that I liked with mezcal. But obviously there's been loads more chance for bartenders to experiment and work on drinks, and probably some slightly lighter styles of mezcal that are arguably better suited to cocktails have came out. That's going to be the key driver, especially in the UK, because the UK is more of a mixed drink market than a neat sipping market. You know, getting people to sip something neat that isn't a scotch or a brandy is sometimes quite difficult, especially if it's an agave spirit. So, and especially if it's a white spirit as well. Generally, aged spirits, people think, oh yeah, you can sip aged spirits, but white spirits, no, you can't sip white spirits. Whereas in the States, if you look at it over there, they're very happy sipping white spirits. You know, one of the reasons why agave spirits have done so well over there.
Yeah, it always makes me wonder why, like you said before, with tequila, the kind of like general like preconception of it is that it's just like a party drink, you're just going to like nail a few back. But culturally, I don't really understand where that's kind of come from, because stuff like that, it tends to spill over from the States, doesn't it? We kind of pick up on some of the trends and whatnot. But then what you say is kind of like the opposite of that. A lot of tequila and mezcal over there is viewed as being like higher end, higher quality. So I don't really get where the kind of like tequila slammer, flavored tequila kind of stuff has come from.
So it's kind of came across in waves. So when in the 1950s, it was really starting to be promoted more there, tequila really took off in terms of volumes in the 60s and the 70s in the States, when the margarita became the world's biggest selling cocktail led by the States. A lot of the production demand couldn't really keep up with the demand. And when you've got a plant like the agave that's very limited, and you have to plan ahead to be able to grow enough for at least, you know, 7-8 years, they just didn't have enough agave. And that's when we start to see non 100% agave tequila come in, coming into play in the 1960s, 1970s. So that's when the quality of tequila dropped quite significantly. As those the production demands went up, so it then started to get promoted as a slammer and different ways to get people to drink more of it, which, to be fair, as a serve, the tequila slammer, we obviously, it's a faux pas and everything. But in terms of marketing bad tequila in the 1960s, 1970s, it was great. You know, you got this kind of ritual that people could get behind, that was something that was a bit fun to do, a bit different. And it helped sell a load of bad tequila to people. But now we're living in the shadow of that. And that, this is coming back to the conversation earlier about denominations of origin and geographical indications protecting spirits. The denomination of origin of tequila didn't come in until 1974. A lot of damage had already been done by that point. And it very much represented the needs of the producers, especially the large producers, rather than keeping that spirit, you know, traditionally in what many felt it should be. So in the States, though, tequila premiumized sort of end of the 80s, early 90s. They started to get more premium brands over there. It's quite a small movement at first, but it really took off. And, you know, over 50% of the tequila drank in the States now is 100% agave. So they were the first to sort of really jump onto 100% agave tequila. Generally sipping white spirits is more accepted and more done over there. So that's part of it as well.
I never really realized until we had a chat about mezcal and other agave spirits before. But I never realized how in Mexico, like just geographically, the terrain can be so different, and there's a variety and fluctuation in the likes of climate and such. Kind of like some of the stuff we were talking about before with rum, obviously we're focusing on like country to country specifics, but it's really fascinating how within one country there can be such a varying degree of, you know, the things that we're really concerned about, the climate and kind of level above, you know, what's the way to put it? I don't know. There's so much variety, you know, within that place. There's such a spectrum of mezcal and other agave spirits out there. It's really cool.
With sugarcane spirits, you're probably limited. Well, you are limited more by where sugarcane will grow, which is generally lower altitude, tropical conditions, where agave has a bigger range of sort of climates and altitudes that will grow across. But actually, on the subject of Mexico, there is a lot of sugarcane spirits that come from there as well, a lot of rums that come from there. You hear about probably one of Bacardi's distilleries in Mexico, which has pretty heavy output. But then they've also got a DO region for Chiranda, which is a sugarcane spirit in Michoacán. So one of the five DO regions in Mexico is actually sugarcane spirit, which is quite interesting. And now we're starting to see a lot of different rums coming out of Oaxaca as well, because they grow sugarcane there. I think Mexico is the fifth biggest sugarcane producer in the world. And obviously a massive amount of distillation and influences on their sort of production techniques of approach to making spirits. So there's some really interesting sugarcane spirits coming out of Mexico now.
Do you think, I always think that kind of agave spirits have some similarities almost with maybe like agricole, where they aren't really like aged very long typically. Even like some of the old stuff isn't, like with agave spirits anyway, but there is that still huge variety of kind of flavors you can get out of it. Go on.
Sorry, I guess with agricole you're getting a lot of flavor from the base ingredient as well. You're using a fresh base ingredient that with fresh sugarcane juice, you get a lot of vegetal, herbal, acidic flavors. You get a real sort of variety of profiles from sugarcane. And it's similar with agave. Agave is the most complex plant that we make spirits from. And you get a lot of different tones from the actual base ingredient. Whereas, you probably get less expression from something like molasses. So, yeah, I typically find agricole and agave spirits are quite comparable in a lot of ways, especially when you start looking at places like Haiti and Mezcal. So if you look at Clarin production and a lot of traditional Mezcal production in Mexico, some of the distilleries look remarkably similar. So both using natural yeast and small-scale distillation, and generally everything's grown in a very natural environment around it. So yeah, there's a lot of comparables.